Well, is have the obits for peak oil come too soon? We've been seeing a lot of obits in the last year. It's been a big year for the Evermore crowd. So what's going on?
Well, you know, a year ago, your listeners may recall, the International Energy Agency in Paris, that's the IEA, released a study announcing that the U.S. would overtake Saudi Arabia to be the world's leading oil producer around 2020. And then when you combine Canadian production by around 2030, North America would be a major energy exporter, not importing oil anymore, but an exporter. And all of this tied up with hydrofracking and tar sands and all kinds of new technology was going to create a new era of energy abundance. And so peak oil, or the notion of oil decline, is out the window. The new reality is energy abundance, and it's going to last for some time to come. So what the pundits were saying is peak oil is dead.
Well, you know, this has really kind of burned me up over the year because they keep talking about all this oil in the ground, and they never say anything, or very rarely say anything, about how expensive it will be, and they don't talk about how much energy it takes to get that oil. You know, like the first oil well in this country where they found oil at 69 feet in Pennsylvania, you know, now they go miles under the ocean and horizontal drilling and fracking and tar sands, and that's bound to cost a lot of money and consume a lot of energy.
Exactly right. And more importantly, I think, involves a great deal of environmental risk,
mm-hmm.
because to extract that, you have to use a lot of force, a lot of aggression, to crack open the earth, and we use water to do that, hydrofracking, and that poses a risk to the water supply. Or you use solvents to turn tar sands into usable fluid oil, and that also poses a threat to the water supply. And I could go on, but
that way you don't need a stove; you can just cook your food out of the water tap.
Well, exactly right. And another thing, Per. They talk about oil, you're talking about oil in the ground, but in many cases what we're talking about is not oil in the conventional sense. It's something else entirely. The oil, what they call oil sands in Canada, I prefer to call it tar sands, is not oil at all. You could drill there and nothing is going to come out of the ground. It's bitumen, a rock-solid form of petroleum that's mixed with rock and clay and sand, and it has to be diluted with all kinds of corrosive chemicals before it could even begin to be moved in a pipeline, which is why the Keystone XL pipeline is so controversial, because it's highly corrosive and poisonous. This is not oil. This is a new commodity altogether.
Well, recently, speaking about the tar sands, is I think there's been a lot of cancer out incidences in that part of Canada.
That is correct. There's a lot of talk because they have to, the water they use in the process of treating this material, this bitumen, and in the solvents, the water that they use for this purpose is toxic, and they store it in tailing ponds, mammoth lakes, man-made lakes that you could see from space. And the fear is these are right next to the Athabasca River, which flows into native people's territories. And there's fear that it's leaking. These toxic carcinogenic chemicals are leaking into the water supply and producing higher cancerous rates in the native people's community.
Well, you talk about these six unconventional liquids. That's something a lot of these people don't even mention. You know, they sort of assume it's all oil. You know, it'll all drive your car, and that is not true, is it?
No. We're talking about a new future in which there is no question about it. The Earth possesses lots of forms of carbon that can be converted into oil if you want to pay the price and the environmental consequences. But it's not oil. It has to be treated. It has to be liquefied. It has to be diluted. It has to be treated chemically and processed in new kinds of chemical plants and factories to be made into a usable product. But it certainly is not oil in the conventional sense that we understand it.
Well, why do you think there's been so much talk? It's been overwhelming. In fact, just today there was an article by David Ignatius, and he is saying that by 2016 we'll be getting 10 million barrels a day in this way, which is actually not very much. But anyway, he talks about it. I think there's some people say that they're sort of pumping up this feeling to boost their oil stocks. Is that correct?
I'm sure that that's part of it. A lot of investment money has flowed into this, to these processes. A lot of hedge funds and bank money has gone into unconventional oil and natural gas. People have heard of the Bakken Formation in North Dakota, the Eagle Ford Formation in Texas. These are the hot prospects. They call them plays, the hot plays for oil development. There's no question that they're going to produce more oil in the future than in before. So a lot of money, a lot of speculative money going into these areas. You know, you put on your cable TV or put on your computer, and there are a lot of companies offering get-rich-quick schemes.
Oh, I see them all the time, yes, yes.
Yeah, so a lot of money flowing, a lot of money tied up in this, and naturally they're trying to boost the idea that this is going to be a bonanza that's going to run forever. Now, there are other people, geologists, saying, watch out, this is a bubble, and the bubble is going to burst.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you mentioned the IEA report of 2012, mm-hmm. but then they came out with another one this last year that a little bit of a turnaround.
Yes, the report that came out in 2013, it came out in November, and I read it very carefully over the past few weeks, and it's a lot more circumspect. They looked a little bit more carefully at all of this. And they're saying, well, yes, there is a lot of this unconventional oil and gas, but it's going to be much more difficult and costly to produce. It does involve more environmental hazards. And as time goes on, we can expect more resistance. There will be resistance to this. Some of it will be in the form of fighting over water, because water is going to become more scarce as a result of climate change. And farmers and ranchers are starting to fight back. You can't take our water. We need it for farming. That's going to cause difficulties. And as climate change advances, there will be increasing pressure on governments to impose either a carbon tax or a carbon trading scheme, something that will push up the price of carbon. And when that happens, these expensive unconventional oil and gas prospects are going to look less attractive.
Well, you mentioned in this the most recent report, they talk about, there's increased production. How long it'll last, we don't know, but there is increased production this way. But you have to balance that against the yearly decline in conventional oil.
Absolutely. And that's this part of the story that nobody is talking about. No question that oil production is increasing in North Dakota and in Texas and a few other places where they're using this new technology, hydrofracking and horizontal drilling. And there are other parts in the world where this is going to be possible. Possibly in Mexico and in Argentina, there's prospects for this. But you have to set this against the reality that in most of the rest of the world, conventional oil fields are in sharp decline, and this will accelerate in the future. So even if we gain a few million barrels a day in North Dakota and Texas, that has to be set against the loss of 65 million barrels a day over the next 25 years from existing fields.
Wow.
And I'm very dubious that we're going to be able to replace all that missing oil.
Well, this is Fight the Empire. My guest is Michael Clare, who's the author of The Race for What's Left and numerous articles. One we're talking about today is about peak oil queries. And while you mentioned Mexico, there's one of the big happy news items has been Mexico is changing its constitution to allow foreign investment. And it looks to me like this foreign investment is mainly Mexico is scraping the bottom of the barrel also with this big Cantarell oil field, and they're asking us to come in and help them scrape it out better.
Yes, well, that's one interpretation of what's happening here. That's the interpretation maybe of the big American oil companies that want to see this happen. Not everybody in Mexico feels the same way. Many people in Mexico say the Constitution is sacrosanct.
Right.
They fought a revolution for this, to keep the oil and gas legacy of Mexico in public hands, not in private hands. And they don't want to change the Constitution. So it's unclear just how much private investment will be allowed in. It's true that the conservative parties in Mexico do want to do this, but I don't know for sure it's going to happen, that they'll be able to open it up to private investment from American companies to develop their unconventional oil and gas. That remains to be seen. There's a lot of resistance in Mexico.
Well, lots of things going on in Mexico now. Apparently, the ordinary people are fighting back against the drug gangs because the government really isn't doing enough, and that's an interesting development right there. They're fighting for their land.
Yes.
But
I've been reading about that. Yeah, I mean, you have a conservative, well, it's not conservative, actually, but the government is perceived by many people as being too overly friendly to giant multinational corporations.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you mentioned in the IEA report, they sort of have these three scenarios. Like one is, I think, 110 million barrels a day by 2035, which is sort of I guess that's the optimistic scenario.
That's the business as usual, no change.
Uh-huh.
You just go on burning oil as if nothing is happening to the planet.
And then there's another one, 101 million barrels a day.
Yeah, that's the one where governments start imposing a carbon tax or a
mm-hmm.
carbon trading scheme of some sort. But we still go on burning oil.
And then finally, there's what you call the 450 scenario. Tell us about that one.
This is a proposed scenario in which the aim is to keep the amount of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere below 450 parts per million.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the level, the maximum amount at which you could keep global temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius or about 5 degrees Fahrenheit, because scientists generally agree more than 2 degrees Celsius and the Antarctic ice sheets will melt, the Greenland ice sheets will melt, the seas will rise God knows how many feet, and New York City will be inundated, and so on and so forth. So you have to try to keep the emissions below 450 parts per million. Now, before I go further, and you have an educated audience, and there are many people like my hero Bill McKibben who say that 350 parts per million is the maximum
That's
we
right.
should go.
Mm-hmm.
And there's 350.org that some of your listeners may be familiar with.
Oh, I'm
so
sure.
Even 450 mm-hmm. parts per million is taking a gamble.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, if you want to keep that at 450 parts per million maximum, then you have to have a very strict controls on carbon emissions. And under that scenario, oil reaches a maximum of about 90 million barrels a day consumption around 2020 and then declines. So there's your peak oil.
There it is. We've
it is.
We've uncovered it. Well, what is the yearly production right now? Isn't it about 89 million barrels a day or something?
Exactly. Yep. Yep. So we're getting very close, and that so 450 scenario would assume that we're very close to what the maximum amount of oil consumption we can have, and still avert global catastrophe.
So I think we should.
And Bill McKibben, we would say we're already beyond that point.
Right. And even if it is 450, we're still kind of roaring ahead. There's all these developments in the pipeline that really can't be turned around very quickly.
Right. Absolutely. And all the unconventional oil we were talking about earlier contain more carbon even than existing oil. So the rate goes up even faster.
Oh, my. And then it has to be scaled down by 2035 also.
I don't know how we're going to do this, but that's what we have to strive to do.
Well, in your article, you know, you focus on, you know, there's one thing I've been reading elsewhere is that, you know, this fracking, it's kind of a bubble because the first year you frack, you know, you do a fracking well or whatever, you know, you get quite a bit of oil back, but it drops off very quickly in the next year or two after that.
That's correct. So what that means is the following. What it means is that you have to move your rig to another location to keep production going. So you have to constantly move your drilling rigs in order to sustain an even level of production, or you have to increase the number of rigs.
And the old wells stay there. They don't get they just get capped or something, don't they?
Well, they keep producing, but mm-hmm. at ever diminishing levels.
Right.
Once you've made the initial investment, you know, whatever you get out of it, even if it's a dribble, you've put money in, but to increase production, you have to start drilling somewhere else. Now, here's the big question. This is what rests whether it's a bubble or not. The question is whether the early guys, the people who went in there first into the Bakken Formation and the Marcellus Formation, did they find the richest deposits and already get the best stuff out, so that each successive well is going to be less prolific? Or are they going to continue to find more and more prolific wells? And only a geologist knows this for sure, but there's some suspicion in that what people in the industry call the sweet spots, the really prolific wells, have already been depleted, so that the new wells are going to be less productive, and therefore the return on investment is going to decline, and eventually you'll have a bubble burst.
Yeah, so basically what you have is this prairie land just dotted with all these fracking wells, because they need one single well does not extract that much oil.
No.
And
no.
It requires...
This is an industrial scale operation. You mm-hmm. have to keep drilling and drilling, and then move and drill some more, and keep drilling and drilling and drilling. And if you don't keep doing that, you lose money.
And doesn't it require a price of about at least $80 a barrel for oil, but more like over $100 a barrel?
It that varies. You know, that varies on the productivity of the field, as I was saying. So if you have if you hit a sweet spot, as they call them,
mm-hmm.
Then you can make a lot of money. But if the next one over could be dry, then you've lost a lot of money. So it's the average of all these fields. And yes, there's some suspicion that we're already seeing a price inflation for drilling in these places. But other people say that's nuts. And as we were saying earlier, there's a lot of money being thrown at this, and they don't want to hear anything about the bubble notion.
Well, it's just, to me, it's just unbelievable. It's, you know, they you hear from these, you know, the the anti-peak oil people that, you know, the price will go way down or something. Well, it's been quite a while now. It never goes below $100 a barrel for, well, the main oil is the, what do they call that, the Brent crude.
Yes. And I think the likelihood is that oil prices are not going to drop much. They may drop some, but not a whole lot, because it's a supply-demand that's curve, and you know the demand is not drying up.
What does that do to the
supply? Is just not growing fast enough to satisfy demand, and so the prices are going to stay high.
And what does that do to the economy? Doesn't that kind of keep the economy just limping along? And if the economy never really grows very much, then how do you pay all these debts we've accumulated?
Well, this is a very interesting international question. You know, some people are doing very well. North Dakota is doing very well,
right.
Thank you, and so is Texas and parts of Pennsylvania. So you have pockets of wealth. The whole economy may not be doing well. And then you have countries like Saudi Arabia, which and Kuwait and all of these other countries facing the Arab Spring. They don't want to see oil prices go down because they need all that money to pay off their youth.
Mm-hmm.
And create artificial jobs for them and all kinds of payoffs to keep them happy and avert a revolution. So they're trying to keep they're reining in production to keep prices artificially high. So there are a lot of competing interests or a lot of combining interests to keep prices high, even though, you know, on a large scale, many people suffer as a result.
Uh-huh. Well, in your article, you kind of focus a lot on, you know, on the climate aspect of this. So why don't we talk about that some more? It's like you actually foresee sort of, I guess you'd call them climate rebellions.
I do. And maybe that's too strong a word because that sounds like something that's going to happen instantaneously. Whereas I think this is going to happen over time with increasing momentum, that as climate change becomes more severe, people's political activism will grow, and there will be more and more demands for governments to impose various kinds of sanctions on carbon consumption. What form that will take is a little hard to say. I think it'll, you know, there may be a universal carbon tax at some point or a cap and trade system. Hard to see what form it's going to take eventually, but there will be, in time, there will be increasingly severe costs on the consumption of carbon around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that will raise the price of using carbon products, fossil fuels, and make the use of renewable fuels increasingly attractive to people. And so over time, you will see a transition, a migration from the use of fossil fuels to the use of renewables, and it will gain momentum. So when I talk about a green revolution, that's what I mean. There
mm-hmm.
will be a gradual but increasingly strong migration or transition from fossil fuels to green technology. But it's not going to be because people suddenly see the light.
Well, kind of momentum, gradual buildup.
It's going to be because climate change is going to become more severe
mm-hmm.
and more intrusive into our lives.
How bad does it have to get? You know,
bad.
Wall Street got flooded. There's a huge heat wave in Australia now. I mean, there's all the heat waves we've had here, the drought in the Southwest. I mean, it's just one thing after another. And now we find out that not only are the oceans rising, but the Atlantic coast is sinking.
Yes, that's just the beginning. And it's going to get a lot worse. it's going to have to get a lot worse before people. Now, I mean, some people have changed already. More and more people are buying hybrid cars,
mm-hmm.
but they're still less than 5% of the car population. The time will come when they're 50% of the car population, but that's going to be a ways down the road.
Well, even then, you have to ask. You have to ask how much is enough. How much? Maybe the measures we have to take are much more drastic than people foresee.
I think so. But I could tell you that the conditions are going to make that happen.
Boy, well, you know, I mean, one thing you hear is that it takes about 20 years to turn an economy around, you know, to deal with this, and we've wasted the last 20 or 30 years. How much time do we have to do these things?
We don't have any time.
Oh, boy. Well, I hear my theme music playing, and we'll end it on that. It's been really, it's been very instructive talking to you, and I really... Do you have a website, or do we just sort of go follow the Tom Dispatch and look for your...
Go to tomdispatch.com.
Mm-hmm. I really have to recommend that. I mean, there's good articles there from a lot of different writers. Anyway, we've been talking with Michael Clare about his most recent article in the Tom Dispatch, and he's the author of The Race for What's Left. Thank you very much for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Pierre.
Stay tuned. I think coming up next is either Air Cascadia or Flashpoints.
Thank you, Pear. Yes, Air Cascadia is coming up next on KBOO Portland, just a minute now before 10 o'clock. In 15 minutes, Flashpoints will start, and today it is an expanded investigation into Lyme's disease and how the medical profession has dropped the ball in dealing with this new emerging epidemic. Harassment against young people working for justice for Andy Lopez will also be discussed on Flashpoints. At 11 today on Between the Covers, host Jennifer Kemp speaks with Mitchell S. Jackson about his autobiographical novel, The Residue Years. And at 11:30 on Radio Zine, host Gene Bradley interviews historian Nathaniel Philbrick about his book, Why Read Moby Dick? That is all coming up, but first it is Air Cascadia with Chris Andre hosting, headlines, interviews, and commentary all coming up on KBOO. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Scanner Foundation's 2014 Martin Luther King Breakfast on Monday, January 20th at 8:30 a.m., at the Oregon Convention Center, 777 Northeast MLK Boulevard in Portland. Each year, the Scanner organizes an inspiring presentation honoring the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and highlights the good work of people making a difference in the community. This year's keynote speaker is Dr. Bruce Goldberg, Oregon Health Authority Director. Again, that's the Scanner Foundation's Martin Luther King Breakfast on January 20th, 8:30 a.m. at the Oregon Convention Center. More information can be found at kboo.fm/MLK Breakfast 2014.
Cascadia. Today is Thursday, January 16th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. Before we get to our first guest today, Nicholas Johnson, we're very happy to welcome him to the KBOO airwaves. He'll be joining us after we go through a few headlines, because a lot's happening around Cascadia, and this is where we plant our feet. But nonetheless, Nicholas Johnson was a commissioner of the FCC, now teaches at the University of Iowa College of Law. And his reflections on net neutrality are what we are going to be hearing today. A brief quote: the genius of the internet has always been its openness. Anyone with an internet connection can access any of its public content from anywhere, anytime. Those features built into the internet's architecture are unfortunately not built into the new net neutrality law. And in other words, every aspect of our lives has been thoroughly corporatized, monetized, and privatized. The only thing that's not privatized is, in fact, our private lives. That said, back to the headlines. The first five-year review is out, and the results are in. The effort to clean up the soil and groundwater contamination at the nation's only plant for assembling and disassembling nuclear weapons has been effective, they say, so far. No report as to how well those who are protecting and doing the assembling and disassembling are doing, but we know that there are cracks in the system. Our military is beginning to show signs of wear and tear, and well, it might, after many, many years of being on high alert that the likes of Mozambique were about to attack us. Republican Clifford Benz, an Eastern Oregonian lawmaker, is floating a bill he hopes would stave off strict federal regulations. Of course. Clifford has found no friend of federal regulations.